From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jerusalem is a holy city for Jews, Muslims, and Christians, and through the centuries, they have fought over who should control it. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Karen Armstrong about her new book, Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths. Armstrong is also the author of the bestseller, A History of God. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on Microsoft's new online magazine and wonders whether traditional journalism will fare well on the web. And Milo Miles reviews a new Curtis Mayfield box set. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The House is scheduled to vote on increasing the minimum wage tonight, but Democrats are complaining that a proposed amendment could gut the measure and actually make millions of workers ineligible for the minimum wage. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
To ease concerns about job losses if the minimum wage is boosted, Republicans intend to pass a package of tax breaks for small firms. But in addition, Pennsylvania Republican William Goodling will offer an amendment exempting some small businesses from having to pay the minimum wage to any future hires. Michigan Democrat David Bonnier says it's an attempt to kill the bill, and he says if it passes, a number of Democrats will oppose it.
I mean, I can't emphasize enough to people, this was done late last night. This amendment will take off anywhere between 3 and 10 million people from coverage of the minimum wage.
Minority Leader Dick Gephardt says some Democrats may want to pass the bill anyway and hope the Senate cleans it up. If not, he says, it may draw a veto. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
At the White House, they're reaffirming President Clinton's pledge to sign a repeal of the 1993 hike in the federal gas tax if Congress approves a clean bill that raises the minimum wage. Spokesman Mike McCurry says the president stands by his pledge to repeal the tax of 4.3 cents a gallon. But McCurry adds the president is still not convinced the nation's oil companies will pass on the savings to consumers. The House approved the gas tax repeal last night. No new talks are scheduled with the Montana Freemen today. The FBI is trying to figure out how to end the two-month standoff following the collapse of face-to-face negotiations yesterday. NPR's Howard Berkus has more.
The latest mediator in the Freemen standoff is going home today, frustrated after 9 meetings in 8 days. Colorado State Senator Charles Duke went to Montana hopeful but is leaving bitter. Duke believed he could get the Freemen to surrender peacefully because he shares some of their views. Now he says some members of the group are merely criminals avoiding prosecution. Duke did succeed in getting the Freemen and the FBI to negotiate directly for the first time in the 8-week-old standoff. But the Freemen are back where they began, refusing to surrender and refusing to recognize the authority of the FBI. Some local officials now hope the FBI will increase the pressure by tightening its perimeter around the Freeman Ranch and cutting off power and water. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
Federal investigators say a dredging operation could begin in about a week in the Florida Everglades at the site of the ValuJet airliner crash. Divers spent yesterday searching the murky waters of a large crater where the jet is believed to have crashed. They found only two pieces of wreckage. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 6.28 points at 5729.98 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. For the second time in as many days, a deadly bomb blast has occurred in India. At least 14 people were killed, another 30 hurt, when a powerful blast tore through a bus in the northwest state of Rajasthan. This follows yesterday's car bombing in a crowded market in New Delhi, which killed 13 people. The bombings come on the eve of general elections in India's states of Jammu and Kashmir. Several groups, including one tied to Sikh militants, have claimed responsibility. In Iraq, Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz called upon the United Nations to lift its remaining economic sanctions against his country. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Tariq Aziz told a student conference in Baghdad that the international economic embargo against Iraq was unjustified. The Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister also accused the United Nations of employing a double standard against Iraq. Aziz said the world body had punished Iraq for its invasion of Kuwait, but refused to take action against Israel for its attacks last month on southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, an official of the United Arab Emirates said his country will appeal to other Arab countries and the Western powers to help end the economic sanctions on Iraq. He told Reuters that Iraq had paid enough for its 1990 invasion of Kuwait. The UN says economic sanctions will remain intact until Iraq complies with the resolutions to completely dismantle its biological, chemical, nuclear, and long-range missile programs and release hundreds of Gulf War prisoners. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
In Australia, the man accused of killing 35 people in Tasmania appeared in court today via video hookup. 29-year-old Martin Bryant appeared on screen from his prison cell. Bryant has been formally charged with one count of murder stemming from the April shootings and fire in Port Arthur. At the hearing, Bryant did not enter a plea. He's due back in court again next month. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jerusalem is a holy city for Jews, Muslims, and Christians. And over the centuries, they have fought over who was there first and who should control the city. My guest Karen Armstrong has written a new book called Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths. It examines how the city became sacred in each of the three traditions. Armstrong is a religion scholar. Her bestseller, A History of God, is a history of monotheism. Her memoir, Through the Narrow Gate, is about her earlier life when she was a nun. In her new book, Jerusalem, she writes that on her first trip to the city, she became aware of the challenge of religious pluralism.
It was a very moving experience for me to go to Jerusalem, which had been imaginatively present to me since I was a young child, when I'd read stories about Jesus, read my Bible stories about King David and King Solomon, the great kings of Israel. And then I found myself actually living and working on these very, very sites. But I also discovered that the city was also holy to Jews and Muslims. For the first time, I became aware, when standing at the Western Wall, that Judaism was more than a prelude to Christianity, that it had a vibrancy and a life of its own. And when I looked up at the great Dome of the Rock, the great golden domed shrine created by the Muslims, I realised that I knew next to nothing at all about Islam. But every Friday afternoon, I'd watch the Muslim people of Jerusalem surging through the streets in their best clothes to attend the Friday service at the Dome of the Rock. So I became aware that all three of these faiths were devoted to Jerusalem and were engaged and had long been engaged in a sometimes deathly struggle for the control of the city.
Now, what was the place that Jerusalem had in your mind as a Christian and as a former nun?
Well, when we were making our morning meditation in the convent, we were told to picture a biblical scene, if we were thinking about Jesus suffering on the cross or carrying his cross through the streets of Jerusalem or praying in agony in the Garden of Gethsemane, we were told to picture the sight to ourselves. And so as one struggled to grow in the spiritual life, Jerusalem became a very strong imaginative presence and very deeply associated with some of the most momentous occasions of my own personal life. So it became more than just a city. It became a symbol, almost a symbol that deeply, deeply connected with God and with deep things in my own identity.
You said that in Jerusalem, the same symbol can have different meanings for people of different religions. Can you give us an example of that?
Well, there are great similarities between the three faiths. A holy city is very often connected with the myth of the Garden of Eden, with that golden age at the beginning of time when it's thought generally in nearly all cultures, men, women and the gods lived in close harmony with one another and with nature and enjoyed complete intimacy with God. There wasn't a huge separation between the human world and the divine world. That myth of that primal golden age is universal. It's found in all cultures. Today, psychologists link it up with our memories of the womb and with our innate feeling that life wasn't meant to be so fragmented and painful and that the divine shouldn't be so far away. And certainly Jews, Christians and Muslims have all associated Jerusalem with the Garden of Eden. But they've done so in very different and distinctive ways.
Let's talk about what Jerusalem means to each of the monotheistic faiths. Let's start with Judaism. Where does Jerusalem enter the story in the history of Judaism?
Well, actually, quite late. It's not connected with any of the great formative events of the Exodus from Egypt, when the Israelites left Egypt and wandered in the wilderness for 40 years and became a people specially covenanted to their God. Jerusalem isn't even mentioned by name explicitly in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, which are the most sacred Hebrew scriptures. It's not until King David conquered the city from the Jebusites about 3,000 years ago that Jerusalem became a holy city for the people of Israel. On that occasion, David brought the Ark of the Covenant, that's the portable shrine which the Israelites had carried around with them in the wilderness, to Jerusalem, and later his son Solomon built a magnificent temple for the Ark, to house the Ark of the Covenant, and the Jews believed that God came to dwell with them permanently, having a permanent home with them in Jerusalem. And they've never forgotten that moment where God entered the temple and united himself permanently with Jerusalem and with the people of Israel. So it's a very, very strong and central commitment for them.
That temple was destroyed after Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians in, I guess it was about 586 BC. What did that do to the place of Jerusalem in Judaism and in Jewish history?
Well, it's one of the characteristics of the long history of Jerusalem that the holy city becomes far more precious to people after they've lost it. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly true with Jerusalem. Up until the destruction of the temple by Nebuchadnezzar, Jerusalem had been a bit controversial for Jews. There were Jews who felt that the whole cult of the temple was a bit too pagan, smacked a bit too much of the other Near Eastern cults. But that all changed when, miraculously, the Jews were allowed by King Cyrus of Persia to return to Judea and to build their temple up again and to rebuild Jerusalem about 539 BC. And that, from that point, Jerusalem became central to the Jews, wherever they happened to be all over the world. Great pilgrimages would be made for the great festivals of Sukkot, of Tabernacles, the Harvest Festival of Weeks, and Passover, where Jews would congregate. Between about 500,000 Jews would be likely to congregate in Jerusalem for these great festivals. And Jerusalem was a complete passion to them. When they fought against the Romans, it was shortly after the time of Christ, when Titus destroyed the temple, they simply gave up their fight and struggle for the holy city. Jerusalem seemed to have lost its meaning. And the loss of the temple was another huge trauma. And yet again, when they lost it, Jerusalem became absolutely central to their spirituality, even though the temple was in ruins. And for many centuries, Jews were not allowed actually even to live in Jerusalem. So it continued to shape and form Jewish spirituality at a very deep level.
And what's the place of Jerusalem today for Jewish people?
I think it's been immensely important to Jews, of crucial importance, since the Nazi Holocaust. For many of them, the only way to deal with that terrible darkness is to look positively at the creation of Israel rising, as it were, like a phoenix out of the ashes. And so the moment when Jews were reunited with the old city of Jerusalem in 1967 after the Six-Day War assumed almost sacred importance. Tough young Israeli commandos clung to the stones of the Western Wall, the last relic of the temple, and wept. And from that moment, Jerusalem became central to the whole thrust and movement of Zionism.
Let's look at the place of Jerusalem for Muslims. Where does Jerusalem enter the history of Islam?
Well, very early, because when Muhammad began to preach to the people of Mecca in the Arabian Hijaz, he taught them to pray facing in the direction of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem was, as the Muslims say, the first Qibla, or direction of prayer. It marked a new orientation for the Muslims away from paganism and towards the God of the Jews and the Christians, to whom Muhammad believed that he was preaching to them, and he was the prophet of this God. Later, that orientation was changed and Muslims prayed facing Mecca. But it was a matter of immense importance to them when they conquered Jerusalem some years after the death of the Prophet Muhammad in 638. It was important to them because the Quran honours prophets like Moses and Jesus and Noah as men of God, as messengers of God. And so Jerusalem was their city, Muslims believed, and so it was very, very important for them too. In fact, they associate it imaginatively with Mecca. There are many Muslim legends that on the last day, the Kaaba, that's the central shrine of Mecca, will fly to Jerusalem and join its great sanctity with the sanctity of Jerusalem, the third holiest city in the Islamic world, and that Jerusalem is therefore the destiny of the whole of humanity.
One of the holiest sites for Muslims is the Dome of the Rock. Would you tell us about its importance?
Yes, it was the first great building that the Muslims ever built. They built it in about 691. And they built it on the site of Herod's temple. It was very important for Muslims to root themselves imaginatively in the place where the earlier faiths had been and worshipped. They also believed that the rock around which the shrine is built was the rock from which the Prophet Muhammad made his ascent to heaven. So it's not a mosque, but it's a place where Muslims like to congregate and meditate on the Prophet Muhammad's mystical experience and hope to reproduce that act of perfect surrender and submission to God in their own lives.
My guest is Karen Armstrong. Her new book, Jerusalem, is about the place of that city for people of the Christian, Jewish, and Islamic faiths. And she is also a religious scholar, a former nun, and author of the bestseller, A History of God. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Karen Armstrong. Her new book is called Jerusalem, and it's about the symbolic value of that city for Christians, Muslims, and Jews. What are the periods where Muslims have been free to live and pray in Jerusalem and periods in which they've been subjugated?
Well, Jerusalem had been a Muslim city from 638, really until 1917, when the British came in and established a mandate after the destruction of the Ottoman Empire. But there was a brief period when Jerusalem was lost to the Muslims when the Crusaders arrived from Europe in 1099 and conquered the city in a most hideous bloodbath. The onlookers say that the blood came up to the knees of the horses. The Crusaders killed every single Jew and Muslim they could lay their hands on in a massacre that lasted for 2 days. And the Crusaders held on to the city and for nearly 100 years until the great Salah ad-Din, the Kurdish soldier, won the city back for Islam in 1187 and conquered it without bloodshed, very different from the Crusaders' conquest. After that point, Jerusalem became very, very specially holy to Muslims in a new way. But they were more defensive about it. The Crusaders had left a deep scar behind, memories of terrible atrocities. And Jerusalem became a much more nervously Islamic city after the Crusades. Nevertheless, Muslims have enjoyed Jerusalem for about 1,300 years.
What would you say is the significance of Jerusalem for Muslims today?
I think, like they have also feel today, that they are in the process of losing their holy city to the State of Israel. They watch the Israelis building their own houses and apartment blocks in Arab land around Jerusalem, and they feel that they're going to lose the city. Now, once a city, Jerusalem always becomes more precious to people after they've lost it. Also, the Palestinian people have suffered their own catastrophe in the 20th century. They've lost their homeland and feel that they have been wiped off the map, as it were. So they also seek healing from the holy city of Jerusalem, so that you have two damaged people, the Jews and the Palestinians, both seeking healing and health from in the same holy city. And that makes a potentially explosive situation.
Let's look at Jerusalem's importance for Christians. What is the significance of that city during the life of Christ?
Well, Jesus came to Jerusalem, as we know, and was crucified there by the Roman authorities, and then rose again from the dead. But it's very interesting that for the first 3 centuries of Christian history, Christians were not interested in Jerusalem at all. They believed that they'd outgrown what they regarded as a rather childish enthusiasm for holy places and shrines. It was only Jews and pagans who went in for that kind of thing. They thought they were having a much more spiritual religion. They didn't need to cling to holy stones and kiss sacred ground. That was an earthbound spirituality, and they wanted something much more spiritual and fine. In fact, they rather reviled Jerusalem as the guilty city because it had crucified Christ and rejected him. But all that changed dramatically, almost overnight, when Constantine, the Roman emperor, converted to Christianity and made Christianity a legal religion in the Roman Empire in 312. And he ordered the Christians to dig up the tomb of Christ, which had been buried under a pagan temple. And as soon as they saw that holy relic rising from the ground, Christians fell in love with Jerusalem passionately. Within a few years of the discovery of the tomb, we find pilgrims coming from as far away as France. That's a 3,000-mile walk over very, you know, difficult and dangerous terrain to simply pray at these holy sites. So it shows the deep strength of these attachments to holy places, which can suddenly spring up and catch us unawares.
What are the holiest sites today for Christians in Jerusalem?
Well, their most holy site, of course, is the tomb of Christ, which is concealed under a rather ornate marble shrine in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which also contains what's left of the rock of Golgotha on which Jesus was crucified. It's also, this holy site is also the site of the most unholy wranglings between the various sects, the Greek Orthodox, the Roman Catholics, the Armenians, the Copts, who fight over every square inch of that sacred ground in a most unedifying way. Things are so bad that a Muslim family has to keep the key of the Holy Sepulchre. This has been an arrangement that's had to be operative since the 18th century because the sects kept locking one another out. So it's only a Muslim has the power to open and lock the doors. It's one of the great scandals, I think, of Christendom, that at the holiest shrine of all, you have this barren struggle for possession.
The future of Jerusalem is still contested. What's at stake for Christians?
Well, Christians have now backed out of any ownership of Jerusalem. The crusading spirit has gone. They don't feel that they should own the holy city anymore. But you have to remember that many of the Palestinians are Christians. And so they have their own devotion to the holy city and will want to worship at their shrines. The Israeli government, however, has been very careful to allow all faiths to worship at their holy sites. So there would be no question ever of Christians being forbidden to pray at their holy shrines, as, you know, some in the past, not all governments have been as accommodating as that.
My guest is Karen Armstrong. Her new book, Jerusalem, is about the importance of that city for people who are Christians, Jews, and Muslims. You say something very interesting in your book. You say the experience of living together in a city sacred to all three faiths could have led monotheists to a better understanding of one another, but that never happened.
Yes. The Muslims instituted a system whereby it was possible for Jews, Christians and Muslims to live together in Jerusalem. Christians had never allowed Jews to live in the holy city. But the Muslims insisted that Jews must have their place in Jerusalem, and they always invited the Jews to come back and settle there. But it didn't happen. And I think that some of the worst tragedies have occurred in Jerusalem when people have concentrated on simply possessing the sacred site, gaining access to the great sanctity of Jerusalem, and have forgotten that Jerusalem is always a moral imperative. It makes a moral challenge, a moral demand. Religion isn't just about having a wonderful healing experience in church or at a holy place. It must also have an ethical dimension. And right from the very, very earliest days, the holiness of Jerusalem had to be connected with social justice and practical compassion. But sadly, people have preferred the easier option of feeling devoted to their holy places to the much, much more difficult demand of charity and respect for the absolutely sacred rights of other people.
Karen Armstrong is the author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths. She'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Karen Armstrong about her new book, Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths. Linguist Jeff Nunberg wonders if Michael Kinsley knows what he's getting himself into now that he's signed on to be editor of Microsoft's new online magazine. And Myla Miles reviews a new Curtis Mayfield box set. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with a religion scholar and former nun, Karen Armstrong. She's the author of the bestseller A History of God. Her new book, Jerusalem, is about how the city became a holy place for Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and how the people of the three faiths have fought for centuries over control of the city. She says that people become particularly possessive of the city when they believe that their faith is the only true faith. Are there different periods historically where people believe their religion is the one true faith and fight off the others, and other periods where people of the religions feel that it is one faith but not the only faith?
Well, an example of the first kind of exclusive religious attitude, I'm afraid, occurs with very much in Christian Jerusalem. As I said, Christians would never allow Jews to live in the city, and they were also bitterly opposed and concerned to eradicate paganism from the holy city. So they and the Crusaders, who must come at the bottom of anybody's list of possessors of Jerusalem, they really felt that it was right to kill people who dared to sully their sacred sites. I mean, they cleared Jews and Muslims out of the holy city as though they were vermin. Now, an example of a more inclusive type of attitude to Jerusalem actually came under Islam. The Muslims instituted a system whereby Jews and Christians were protected minorities. They were dhimmis, protected minorities. They had full religious rights. They were subject to Islam. They weren't given equality, but they were given some legal standing in the city, and their holy sites were not to be molested. When the Caliph Umar conquered Jerusalem in 638, he was taken to the Holy Sepulchre Church, and he was taken round, to look at the city that he'd conquered. And while he was standing by the tomb of Christ, the time for Muslim prayer came round, and the Greek Orthodox Patriarch invited Umar to pray there beside the tomb, and Umar said no, and he went outside the church and prayed in the street outside. "If," he said, "I had prayed in by your tomb, the Muslims would have wanted to make a mosque there to commemorate the first Islamic prayer in the holy city. And it's essential that you must keep your holy place intact. That's why I prayed outside." So, and also in the Quran, in those early days at least, Islam did not believe it was the one true faith. Islam thought that it was simply a new version of the an Arab version, if you like, of the old religion of the one God that who was worshipped by Jews and Christians. So the Muslims were able to set up a system of coexistence. Things weren't perfect, and at times of tension, especially after the Crusades, as I've said, things could get very nervous and nasty. But generally, there was an acceptance of Jews and Christians in Jerusalem. And in fact, until the Crusades, Muslims really regarded Jerusalem as a city of dhimmis, of Jews and Christians. It was not an Islamic city, but it had an important Islamic shrine.
In your book, Jerusalem, you write that many of the difficulties arise when religion is seen primarily as a quest for identity. Mm. One of the functions of faith is to help us build up a sense of self, to explain where we've come from and why our traditions are distinctive and special. But that's not the sole purpose of religion.
No. Religion is also to help us to get beyond the ego. Not just to build up a sense of self, but to go beyond our own selfishness, to go beyond that voracious, hungry, frightened, insecure ego that is clamorous and often destructive of other people, feels threatened by other people encroaching on our space. When religion forgets that its job is to help us to rise above the self, and especially when it forgets to teach us to recognize that God is not only found in holy cities, but also enshrined in each human being with whom we come in contact, then I think you have a very explosive situation. And religion isn't always good. There are bad forms of religion too. And I think we see bad forms of religion in Jerusalem today. The murder of President Rabin for the Holy Land by one of his own people was one example of bad religion. The suicide bombings of the Islamic group Hamas are another example of this bad religion, where people have forgotten that to recognize the sacredness of each human individual.
There's such a long history of feuding over claims to Jerusalem and which religion was there first and which religion's claims are more legitimate. Do you see the claims and the symbolic significance of Jerusalem to all three forms of monotheism as being equally legitimate?
Yes, I do, because nobody was there first. Every time Jews, Christians and Muslims say the word Jerusalem, they should be reminded that before monotheism came on the scene, Jerusalem was a holy city for pagans. Jerusalem seems to me have meant originally the god Shalem has founded this, Shalem being a Syrian god. So whenever monotheists have come into the city, they've had to recognize that other people were there first. The Bible makes it very, very clear that Abraham, when Abraham came into the Promised Land, he had to deal with people who were already established there and respect their sacred traditions. The book of Genesis tells us that he visited a place called Salem, which is often associated with Jerusalem, and was there blessed by Melchizedek, the king and priest of Jerusalem, who blessed him in the name of his own God. So there you see the father of Israel, the father of Jews, Christians and Muslims, honouring the religion and of another faith. All Jews, Christians and Muslims, they've all attached themselves imaginatively and spiritually to Jerusalem. What a wonderful thing it would be if we could make Jerusalem really Zion, the city of peace, foretold by, looked forward to so eagerly by the prophets, where people of different religions could live together.
My guest is Karen Armstrong, author of the new book Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Karen Armstrong is my guest. She's a religious scholar, a former nun, author of the bestseller A History of God, which was a history of monotheism, and the author of the new book Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths. You know, it seems to me that you're part of of a trend, at least in America, where it seems to me more and more people are turning to religious scholars, to writers, literary people, for their interpretations of biblical history, of religious history, as opposed to just turning to their local priest or clergyman or rabbi.
Yes, I think there's a great curiosity, and I think there's a great spiritual hunger, both in America and even in my own rather godless country of Britain, where people are leaving the churches but still are seeking forms of faith and want to know about religion because they feel it to be important. And I think the rabbis and priests and imams should take note of this. People want also to know about other traditions too, I think. I've found that. That they find it affirming, actually, to know that their religion or their religious tradition isn't just a lonely little idiosyncratic quest beating out its own solitary path, but it's part of a whole human, universal endeavour to find, against all the odds, some meaning and value in human life. That's our principal job on earth, it seems to me. And the religions have a wisdom to teach us, but we can also learn an immense amount from other people's faith, learn what they may have managed better than us. I mean, I think we Christians can learn a lot from Muslims, the past history of Islam at least, on the question of Jerusalem, of how to better to live with other people of other faiths.
The Bible is, in a way, the most common text in Western civilization. On the other hand, a lot of people have never read it. And I think probably a lot of people are growing up in homes where religion isn't practiced. And I wonder if you've seen a shift at all. You're a professor. If you've seen a shift at all in the number of people you come across who seem to know or not know the Bible.
I think in England, an increasing number of people don't know anything about the Bible and don't read it. I was once teaching a student who had to ask me what happened on Good Friday. She seemed quite ignorant of the crucifixion of Jesus. It is extraordinary, and I think this is very desperately sad too, because the Bible is at the source of our Western imaginative literary creative tradition, and to be cut off from your roots means and also to fail to understand the underlying spirit of the Bible means that you're cut off from so much that's rich and nourishing in your own culture. But on the other hand too, there is this curiosity to find out more about the historical Jesus. For example, quite a number of popular television and radio programs devoted to biblical subjects, to laying aside myths, some of which have been destructive in the past, but to see the kernel of what is there. And so perhaps people need, sometimes the Bible has been used a bit in a rather limited way, as though it was a kind of holy encyclopedia in which you could look up information about God. But people are beginning to be interested in reading it as literature, as a great imaginative attempt to find some meaning in life. And so I think there is that strand too. People are turning to it in a rather secular way, perhaps, but to look at what these stories really mean, what these stories have to tell us.
Do you have much contact with fundamentalists who take the Bible as the literal word of God?
Not personally, but my next book is going to be about fundamentalism, a history of fundamentalism in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. There aren't so many fundamentalists in Britain as there are here. I think in Britain people are tending to walk away from the faiths altogether or to seek refuge in Buddhism, a non-theistic religion, rather than in Christianity somehow. But I am very interested in the phenomenon of fundamentalism, people who look at the Bible in a literal way. This is part of our modernity. It's going to go with us into the 21st century. And it is therefore terribly important for us to understand it, because the more we that we revile fundamentalists or ridicule them or see them as opposed to progress, then the more defensive and aggressive they are likely to become. So I think that's going to be my next big project, is to look at what fundamentalism means for us at the end of the 20th century.
Christianity, Judaism and Islam each play a part in your spiritual life, and you know so much about the history of each of the three monotheistic faiths. Do you ever feel unwelcome in the shrines of religions that you were not born into when you visit them, or if you go to a synagogue or a mosque and if people suspect that you're not born into the faith, are you ever given the cold shoulder?
No. As a matter of fact, I'm not. I'm more given the cold shoulder by Christians, funnily enough, in England, who, you know, especially my own Roman Catholic tradition, who regard me as, you know, still as a bit as a runaway nun. But I find enormous openness and enthusiasm when I go to services in mosques or in synagogues. I teach in a Jewish college in London. I teach future rabbis Christianity, as it happens, and we have wonderful talks with the students and I about religion. One of the high points of my academic year is the day when I teach my Jewish students the meaning of the Trinity and watch the scales fall from their eyes, and they say, oh, it's just like we have in our Jewish mysticism. So all that is wonderfully exciting. My Jewish friends tease me and tell me I'm about to convert to Judaism and become a rabbi. My Muslim friends are hourly expecting my conversion to Islam. But actually, at the moment, I'm quite happy to remain what I call a freelance monotheist. I'm at the moment drawing a great deal of sustenance from studying and immersing myself in the study of other traditions and learning in the process a great deal more about what my own tradition at its best was trying to do.
Karen Armstrong, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Karen Armstrong's new book is Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths. She lives in London. The Microsoft Corporation scored a big coup a few months ago when they hired Michael Kinsley to edit a new online magazine. As the former editor of Harper's and The New Republic, Kinsley promised to take online writing to a new, more serious and responsible level. Linguist Jeff Nunberg joins those who wonder whether traditional journalistic forms will work on the web. As a linguist, Jeff says he's not so much interested in what the new magazine will say as in how it will be punctuated.
I wish Michael Kinsley well with his new magazine, but I have to say I have some concerns. I'm sure he'll give us the same sort of writing online that he's provided off it, thorough, thoughtful, informed, but I'm not sure he quite understands the concessions that the new medium requires. One difficulty was suggested in an offhand remark of Kinsley's when he said of the new magazine that it wouldn't scream cyberspace, but just suggest it with a wink. Of course, I knew Kinsley was talking about winking in a purely metaphorical way, but in electronic discourse, the winks are often a bit more literal than that, when they come in the form of what are called smileys. For the benefit of any of you who still belong to the great unwired, I should explain that a smiley is a little string of punctuation marks that's supposed to suggest a facial expression laid on its side. So you write a colon, followed by a dash, and then a closed parenthesis, and if you tilt your head, you can sort of see this as a smiling face. People append this little symbol to their messages whenever they fear that their readers may not discern their ironical intent. Or you can put in a semicolon in place of the colon and get a winking face. Or you can change the closed paren to an open paren and turn the smile into a frown. And there are other smileys to express anger or surprise or wry indifference. People have published whole books of these things. Sometimes they're called emoticons, a word which is a blend of emotion and icon. It deserves to die horribly in a head-on collision with infotainment. In its own small way, the smiley is as significant a sign of the revolutionary implications of digital media as anything else I can think of. After all, the system of Western punctuation has been pretty much fixed since the 17th century, a measly half dozen or so marks that have to do duty to render all the tones and nuances that the human voice is capable of. And now, all of a sudden, We have dozens more of them. It's an increase in expressive power that's like moving from a quill pen to a high-powered workstation. You can't help wondering what earlier writers would have done if they'd had these devices at their disposal. For example, Swift could have put a smiling face at the end of A Modest Proposal, so no one would think he really expected the Irish to eat their babies. And the sad face would have been useful to Kafka as a way of tipping off the readers of The Metamorphosis that they were in for a bleak allegory and not a science fantasy romp. Gregor Samsa awoke one morning to find himself transformed into a monstrous insect, :. With Jane Austen, by contrast, it would be winkies all the way down. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in need of a wife, :. Of course, I can hear you Janeites out there getting shirty. Surely she would never have stooped to such a maneuver. Well, maybe not, so long as she was sending her words in print to an anonymous audience. But I suspect she would have given serious consideration to the expedient if she had sent the text in electronically to a list like rec.fiction, if only to spare herself the flames that would otherwise have come searing back over the net. To Jane at Chawton.uk from Sparky at CompuServe.com. I'm tired of seeing this list fill up with all this heterosexist garbage. A truth universally acknowledged? Where'd you get that? Have you done a poll? Get real, Jane. Still, for all the usefulness of smileys, I have the sense that neither Michael Kinsley nor the writers in his new magazine will be making much use of them when it first appears next month. Kinsley's crowd isn't the sort to tip their hands. But in that case, maybe they'd be better advised to stay offline. I'd be the last to deny that that old implicit irony has done yeoman service in traditional literature. But you have to admit that it's something of an elitist device, which can only work if the writer presupposes that half the audience isn't getting the point. And this sort of elitism doesn't sit well in a medium where the audience is a true plebiscitory democracy, where every reader has the right to demand an explanation. And if the smileys serve that democratic purpose by making meaning clear to all, well, the death of literary irony is a small price to pay. Period.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Coming up, a new Curtis Mayfield box set. This is Fresh Air. Curtis Mayfield may be best known for his 1972 hit Superfly, but his career as the originator of the Chicago soul sound began in the early 60s. A new box set from Rhino Records called People Get Ready surveys his long career. Critic Milo Miles says that while Mayfield may be the hardest major soul singer to get to know, he's well worth the effort.
From nowhere, through a caravan, around a campfire light, a lovely woman in motion, with hair as dark as night. Her eyes were like that of a cat in the dark, that hypnotized me with love.
In the 1960s soul years, Detroit had Motown and Memphis had Stax Records. But no one record company came to define the scene in Chicago. That's the first reason Curtis Mayfield is not as celebrated as he might be. He changed from label to label over the years. Now you can get all his phases together on one label in the first really comprehensive survey of Mayfield's career, the 3-CD set People Get Ready. Although Mayfield was not an original member of the late 50s harmony group The Impressions, he soon came to embody them as singer, songwriter, and vibrant guitarist. After scoring with lovely romantic numbers like Gypsy Woman and I'm So Proud, Mayfield made history in 1964 with what is arguably the first civil rights soul hit, Keep On Pushing.
Keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength, and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing.
Mayfield was the most wholly admirable performer in all of soul music. He was tender, sexy, and strong in his love songs, avoiding the usual put-downs of women. He used his roots in gospel as a source of dignity and optimism. And finally, he was an eloquent social activist who wrote and sang numbers that told Black America to make its own way, never take guff, but above all, get going ahead.
Hush not, child, and don't cry. Might understand you by and by. Just move on up toward your destination, though you may find from time to time complication.
Mayfield began his solo career in 1970 and flourished. His fourth release was the soundtrack for the film Superfly, a landmark collection of songs as vivid and fast-moving as any screen images. But the tenor of the times was growing harder to follow. Mayfield never made solo albums as consistent as his first few. While he was a champion innovator in hard, funky rhythms, he chased disco trends unsuccessfully. Even his love songs began to sound generic, his releases stopped being news, and he got little crossover action. In 1990, a lighting scaffold fell on him at an outdoor concert, and he was paralyzed from the neck down. The only good note was that the tragedy renewed interest in Mayfield, and the third CD of the People Get Ready collection does an admirable job selecting from his later solo work.
Waking up to find yourself creeping. Check your fears and hope that you dream. A little space is all that it needs. Suckers, just allow me to breathe. Slave puts in Lucifer's brains. Can't take the strength I've earned to learn. Stepped in death of the same living hell. Ain't too proud to die here as well.
Yet I'm not sure the box set is the only way to go. A 2-CD retrospective called Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions, the anthology 1961 to 1977, is still available on MCA. It's cheaper, it gives a fuller picture of the Impressions, and it does about as good a job on solo Mayfield. Either way, those who lack this sweet soul man in their library should pick up one or the other. Established Mayfield fans should check out the single disc reissue, Curtis Mayfield's Chicago Soul on Columbia Legacy. It's a smoothly programmed survey of his work as a talent scout, songwriter, and producer. Featured performers include Major Lance, Gene Chandler, and Walter Jackson. The soothing light touch to everything is a timely reminder why the Chicago style is a favorite of many old-line soul enthusiasts. Though it's hard to see all at once, Curtis Mayfield created his own kind of empire.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He reviewed People Get Ready on the Rhino label. He also referred to the anthology on MCA and Curtis Mayfield's Chicago Soul reissue on Columbia Legacy. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
There's a set going strong, a lot of things going on. The man of the hour has an air of great power. The dudes have envied him for so long. Oh, super.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Vision, a direct-to-desktop customized news service. This is NPR, National Public Radio.